last edition of the London Aesthetics Forum for the term. Before we begin, as usual, I'd like to thank the British Society of Aesthetics for their generous support of this series. And I would then like to welcome Catherine Elgin, who is Professor of Philosophy of Education at the Harvard Graduate School in Education, and has a long and distinguished career, as you probably know, working primarily in epistemology, but also with a very lively interest in aesthetics and related issues in philosophy of science, with a general theme that what we're after in these domains is something that's not just the usual philosophical notion of knowledge, but a broader sense of understanding, so that art contributes to that just as much as science, something we're very gratified to hear here at the Aesthetics Forum. So won't you join me in welcoming Catherine when she speaks to us on nature's handmaiden art.
The title actually comes from Dryden, and initially, his view is you have nature sort of prettying, art prettying up nature. But actually, I think that's not fully respective of handmaidens. And that if you actually think about what handmaidens do, it's a much more substantive job. And so in calling art the handmaiden of nature, I'm going to be saying it's not just a matter of prettying things up. I'm actually not going to talk about prettying things up at all, but it did seem to me that if we gave due respect to handmaidens, we'd see that there's a lot more involved than you might think. Many people, and not all of them are philosophers, consider art non-cognitive. They believe it bypasses reason and operates directly and exclusively on the emotions. This view is more problematic than it might initially seem. It's plausible that we would value encounters that put us in a positive frame of mind. It's implausible that we would value encounters that evoke negative emotions. So if aesthetic non-cognitivists are right, then the attraction of dark works and of dark aspects of cheery works is very hard to fathom. The Black Goyas, Mahler's Ninth Symphony, Oedipus Rex, Hitchcock's Psycho, Stellark's Muscle Machine are richly rewarding works of art, but they're by no means pleasant. They're harrowing, depressing, terrifying, and are downright creepy. Nonetheless, we're drawn to them. And even pleasant works are not entirely sunny. There are minor chords in Beethoven's Ninth, intimations of the crucifixion in Raphael Madonna's, and a certain mean-spiritedness in Puck's Machinations. And these are not defects in the works. If the value of art consists in evoking emotions, then we should value art that evokes emotions that we already value: happiness, joy, giddiness, serenity, and so forth. We should not value works that evoke emotions we shun: sorrow, fear, revulsion, and the like. I mean, think about something like this. Nobody turns to her spouse one evening and says, "We've been too cheerful lately. Let's go to the movies and get depressed." I mean, if you thought that the idea was to get the emotions, then you kind of say, "I want to go out and get depressed." I don't think this is what happens. But we value dark works as well as light ones. And this suggests that a purely emotive account of the value of art does not align with our aesthetic assessments. We often emerge from encounters with works of art claiming to have learned something. And what we take ourselves to have learned is not just something about the work of art, like that Shakespeare had a big vocabulary, or that Borges had a feel for paradox, or that Bach really knew his way around the fugue. Rather, we take ourselves to have gained some kind of insight or understanding about the world beyond the aesthetic realm. If the arts are non-cognitive, we're simply wrong. Maybe an encounter with a work of art provoked a change of mind, but that would be incidental and accidental. We could not plausibly maintain that the work showed or revealed or disclosed anything about the work. At best, it prompted us to think something new. And this, too, is at odds with what we say about art. And I want to say I believe we're right to claim that through encounters with art, we learn something about the extra aesthetic world, and that because we do, it makes sense to be drawn to dark works as well as light ones. But this is epistemologically problematic, for rarely do works of art engender new justified literally true beliefs. For the most part, they say nothing about the real world, and many say nothing at all. So if we restrict our conception of the cognitive to the realm of justified literally true beliefs, then the contention that arts function cognitively is implausible. This is what Mary Mothersill thought. Epistemology is about justified true beliefs, art's not giving you that, end of story. But I think this is an unduly narrow conception of the cognitive. And as I've argued elsewhere, it can't even do justice to the cognitive claims of science. Since I take it that the cognitive claims of science are beyond dispute, the realm of the cognitive must be broad enough to accommodate them. I believe that the best way to do for epistemology to accommodate science is to shift the center of gravity from knowledge to understanding, where understanding involves apprehending, endorsing, and properly employing a comprehensive system of mutually supportive commitments in reflective equilibrium. I will argue that in much the way that science does, the arts embody, convey, and advance understanding. Once we appreciate the multiple and complex modes of symbolization by which the sciences advance understanding, we see that the differences between science and art are largely differences in degree rather than differences in kind. Both science and art symbolize reality in ways that make it epistemically accessible. Many works of art do so in ways that involve emotions. So it will turn out, the reason why we should value works that evoke negative emotions is that they too are vehicles of understanding. To make my case, I should begin by saying a very little bit about understanding. I've argued that an understanding consists of a system of cognitive commitments in reflective equilibrium. These commitments include beliefs, methods, standards, perspectives, and so forth. Together, they constitute what Bos van Vrossen calls a stance. Some of the commitments are antecedently acceptable. We have good reason to endorse them independently of the system in question. Others are acceptable only because of their role in the system. For example, for a time, the scientific community was committed to the existence of positrons, not because it had any direct evidence of positrons, but because it was committed to symmetry and to the existence of electrons. If electrons exist and symmetry holds, then there exist positively charged counterparts to electrons. That's to say, positrons. But because the elements of the system are reasonable in light of one another, they're in equilibrium. Because the system as a whole is as reasonable as any available alternative in light of our antecedent relevant commitments, its equilibrium is reflective. It's one we can, on reflection, endorse. It's important to realize that the commitments we start with in constructing such a system need not be true and are not assured a place in the system we construct on the basis of them. We realize that our antecedent commitments are, to one degree or another, inadequate. But they're our current best take on the matter at hand. So they have some claim on our epistemic allegiance. We need a reason to give them up. Often the reasons are readily available. The system need not, and typically does not, incorporate all our initially seemingly relevant commitments. But if it corrects or rejects them, it should, at least for the most part, show why they seemed as reasonable as they did when they did. It might show, for example, that they were supported by the limited evidence we then had available, or by outdated statistical methods or something like that. On this conception, the advancement of understanding proceeds by bootstrapping, by making a series of revisions that depends on, as well as corrects and amplifies, what we already reasonably accepted. Not surprisingly, results are always provisional. Reflective equilibrium can be upset by further findings. But a system in reflective equilibrium that incorporates our cognitive commitments about a subject matter, the proper methods for studying that subject matter, and the standards for evaluating our findings constitutes an understanding of that subject matter. Although we might subsequently find reason to give it up, such a system is reasonable in the epistemic circumstances. Rather than elaborate and defend this general epistemological position, I want today to focus on a few respects that are particularly relevant to art. The picture I sketch does not privilege the literal, the descriptive, or the true. Non-propositional components of a system are as crucial as propositional ones. Non-literal sentences are as tenable as literal ones. If we have reason to accept a metaphorical sentence, it should, ceteris paribus, be woven into our system of thought. So, for example, the sentence, Syria teeters at the edge of the abyss, can be incorporated into a system that constitutes our understanding of the world political situation, despite the fact that the abyss in question is metaphorical. Symbols that exemplify rather than denote or describe may be aspects of an understanding. A telling instance that shows rather than says may belong to a tenable system of thought. A description of a football play or tango step would not convey as full an understanding as a reenactment would. An account of a political liberty that described a range of rights but provided no examples of what their exercise looks like is apt to be inadequate. Symbols that are not true and are known not to be true may also be elements of tenable systems of thought. Science includes models, idealizations, and approximations, as well as thought experiments that are known not to be true, but that nonetheless figure in an understanding of the subjects they bear on. The choice of taxonomy, orientation, and/or grain may also be crucial to the understanding a system provides. So the fact that many works of art do not impart literal descriptive truths does not by itself preclude their advancing understanding. Nevertheless, to show that art does advance understanding of the extra-aesthetic world, we need to explain how it does so. Simply saying it's not impossible is rather a weak claim. It might seem that even with the resources my epistemology provides, our prospects are dim. For the arts to afford understanding of something, they must bear on that thing. And the question is how the arts bear on anything in the extra-aesthetic world. Well, in some cases, the answer is straightforward. Fables and allegories pretty plainly are about their subject matters. They refer non-literally but straightforwardly to what they're about. But of course, most works of art cannot plausibly be construed as fables or allegories, so much work remains to be done. How can a symbol that does not denote P and is not an instance of P nonetheless afford an understanding of P? To answer this, we should look not first to art, but to science. If we want to know whether water conducts electricity, for example, which is a high school science experiment that people often do, we don't try to induce an electrical current in a local lake, pond, or puddle. The water in such places contains impurities. If we were to find an electric current in water in the wild, we would not know whether the current we detected was due to the electrical conductivity of water or to the impurities. Instead, we go to the lab and try to induce an electric current in a water sample from which all impurities have been eliminated. In case the conductivity is slight, as it turns out to be, the experiment then has to magnify or amplify the result in order to make it detectable. So we subject a relatively small amount of pure distilled water to a very strong electric current, run the result through an amplifier, and see what happens. That is, we create a substance that is not to be found in nature and subject it to forces unlikely to occur in nature, magnify the result, and study the output in order to understand what goes on in nature. We simplify, streamline, manipulate, and omit so that the confounding factors which could impede understanding are eliminated or their effects are minimized, marginalized, or canceled out. We amplify, augment, and exaggerate so that delicate factors we want to discern are detectable. This is standard operating procedure in science. We study entities that are not found in nature by subjecting them to provocations that do not occur in nature in order to figure out what's going on in nature. It's plain how such procedure would reveal something about what's going on in the lab. The experiment is carefully constructed and rigorously conducted so that the result is manifest. The experiment reveals that this particular water sample is very slightly conductive. That is, the experiment not only instantiates the water sample's slight conductivity, it also exemplifies that level of conductivity. And the experiment is designed in such a way that it is reasonable to believe that the result holds not just for this pure water on this occasion, but for pure water any time in general. It's reasonable to believe that what this sample exemplifies is instantiated by all pure water. So the water in the experiment is readily recognized as a representative sample of pure water in general. This allows scientists to extrapolate beyond the particular case to a wider class of cases. But I said earlier, pure water, lacking in impurities, is not to be found in nature. To take the result to reveal anything about the conductivity of natural water, the scientists need to project beyond the pure case and correct for or provide reasons to disregard the falsifications that were introduced in the lab. Their projections and corrections are grounded in an understanding of how the experimental situation departs from and reflects back on the natural. Therefore, scientists either reintroduce as correction factors some of the features that were intentionally omitted, or they make it plain how the finding represents only one factor in what happens in the wild, or they explain why the additional complications raised by impurities are irrelevant. For our purposes, the important point is this. The experiment is highly artificial, but rather than rendering it uninformative, its divergence from nature enable it to reveal aspects of nature that are often overshadowed. The experiment then exemplifies something that obtains but is hard to discern in nature. Once this elusive factor has been recognized, it and its effects can be seen outside the lab. I suggest that an experiment is a carefully contrived fiction. This is a Nancy Cartwright type argument. It's designed to bring out particular features and draw out their consequences. It deliberately departs from nature in order to advance an understanding of nature. Like literary fictions, it manipulates circumstances, exaggerating, omitting, and distorting so that significant features are made manifest. If this is so, then in whatever way experiments advance understanding, other fictions can in principle do so too. How do experiments advance understanding? They provide telling instances that exemplify factors that they investigate. They simplify, amplify, and falsify so that those features and their effects stand out. If the issue in question is whether water conducts electricity, the experiment is carefully contrived so that it is possible to tell whether an electric current is present, and if it is, nothing could plausibly be the conductor except water. In that case, the experiment exemplifies water's conductivity. Similarly, if, as Aristotle contends, the issue is why we should call no man happy until he's dead, we look to Oedipus Rex. By portraying an extreme case and eliminating everything extraneous, the play, like an experiment, is carefully contrived to exemplify human vulnerability and the precariousness of good fortune. Exemplification is a mode of reference by which a sample or example refers to whatever it's a sample or example of. This is a definition. If X exemplifies Y, if and only if X instantiates Y, and thereby refers to Y. An exemplar is not a mere instance of a property, then. It's a telling instance, one that makes the property epistemically accessible. The sample cards that the paint manufacturers distribute are typical exemplars. They provide easy, unambiguous access to the colors of paint that the manufacturer makes. The maker of the sample card has a relatively easy job. He knows what features his exemplars need to exemplify. He has on hand some Benjamin Moore Jonquil yellow paint. His job is to replicate that color on the sample card. But in the scientific case, things are not so straightforward. The experiment is designed to exemplify, even though the experimenter does not know in advance what will be exemplified. The result will exemplify whatever is the case with regard to water's conductivity. So the experiment extends our cognitive range by showing something we did not previously know or adequately appreciate. It does so because we, or at least the scientists among us, know how to interpret the result. An experimental finding, like any symbol, requires interpretation. Background information about the domain, the experimental setup, the presuppositions, and the limits on accuracy, scope, and significance fix the context. Fluency in mathematical and scientific idioms that describe the experiment, embedded in theory, and express the result is needed. We must know what to extrapolate and how to extrapolate from the finding in the lab in order to glean an understanding of the natural world. Because we, or at least the scientists among us, know how to do such things, we can derive an understanding of nature from something artificial. I discuss a very pedestrian scientific experiment in some detail to emphasize the artificiality and symbolic character of even the simplest advances in scientific understanding. It would be no surprise that the factors that I take to be significant in the advancement of scientific understanding are also to be found in the arts. This is not to say that there are no differences between science and art, although I believe the similarities may be more significant than the differences, and many of the differences are differences in degree rather than differences in kind. But it is to say that there is good reason to think that the arts advance understanding in much the way that the sciences do. I already said that experiments are fictions. They are, in effect, dramatic enactments. They're artificially contrived to bring certain features to the fore and make them epistemically accessible. Just as Sophocles or Shakespeare or Stoppard carefully sets the stage and introduces only those protagonists, props, and predicaments as will serve his dramatic ends, so a scientist carefully designs the experiment and introduces only such factors as will serve her scientific ends. In both cases, I suggest, those ends are to bring it about that something significant is exemplified. And in both cases, it may not be obvious what will be exemplified until the experiment or the drama is enacted. Not all literary fictions are dramas, though. The parallel between science and art might seem to fail as soon as we go beyond the dramatic arts. But there's another parallel that extends the connection further. Science uses thought experiments. These are imaginative exercises designed to exemplify what would happen if certain conditions were met. The conditions typically are not met, and in some cases, like Einstein's thought experiment about a person riding on a light wave, they cannot be met. Nevertheless, they illuminate the theory and its commitments and yield insights that may be testable in fact. And they do so by getting the reader to suspend disbelief. That's exactly what you have to do. Imagine what it would be like to ride on a light wave. Okay, you have to suspend disbelief in all sorts of reasons why this is impossible. Light waves go too fast, they're too small. If you happen to get beyond that, your head would be so small that a photon would decapitate you rather than give you something to see. Never mind all of that. Disregard all of those and then see what you would see. That's what you have to do. And if you know how to do the thought experiment, you know to suspend disbelief in all of these complications. So literary fictions, I suggest, do the same thing. They set up an artificial scenario and investigate what would happen if certain, perhaps unrealizable, conditions were met. When Jane Austen said, three or four families in a country village is the very thing to work on, which she said in a letter to her niece, who was also an aspiring writer, she in effect set the parameters for a tightly controlled thought experiment. The relations among the members of the three or four families are sufficiently complicated and the demands of village life sufficiently mundane that the story can reveal something about the effects of ordinary actions on the development of moral character. In both thought experiments and works of fiction, we're invited to suspend disbelief and consider what would happen if certain conditions were satisfied. In neither case can we just unthinkingly extrapolate from the fictional setting to the real world. But in both cases, we may find patterns, problems, possibilities, and properties that obtain in the real world, but that are ordinarily obscured or overridden by factors that the thought experiment set aside. Nevertheless, there's still more to art than literature. Plenty of art, including non-representational painting and absolute music, as well as many aspects of the representational arts, might seem left in the dust by this account. I disagree. For exemplification is ubiquitous in the arts as well as in the sciences. Non-representational works and non-representational factors in representational works exemplify and thereby afford epistemic access to properties, patterns, regularities, and singularities that we might otherwise miss. They equip us with new ways to see and conceptualize things. As Goodman says, after we spend an hour or so at one or another exhibition of abstract painting, everything tends to square off into geometric patches or swirl in circles or weave into textural arabesques to sharpen into black and white or vibrate with new color consonances and dissonances. Seeing in terms of geometric patterns or textural arabesques is a new way of seeing familiar objects. We discern aspects we had previously overlooked. Impressionist paintings and music may finally make clear to us what sense datum theorists were talking about. I actually think this is true. You'd do much better to read Mrs. Dalloway than to read G.E. Moore if you want to know what sense datum theory is about. Cubist works may make manifest both the desirability and the impossibility of accurately representing Kant's thing in itself, or seeing the world from a God's eye point of view. Here's what something that took every perspective would look sort of like. Something similar occurs in science. Much scientific progress involves noting previously undetected patterns or discrepancies in the data, that is, reinterpreting so that different features are exemplified. Reassigning factors to signal or noise, or reassessing their import may make a huge difference in our understanding of a topic. This is precisely what our encounters with non-representational aspects of works of art do. We know patterns and juxtapositions at varying levels of abstraction. We provide alternative interpretations of the works that we see. We assign significance to some factors and see what sort of understanding emerges. And we assign significance to others and see what difference it makes. Is the shape of Libeskind's Jewish Museum in Berlin a zigzag or a broken Star of David? Are the hallways that end in abruptly in blank walls exemplifying or only instantiating dead ends? Our answers affect how we experience the work of architecture and what we take away from this experience. I've been arguing that exemplification is common to art and science and critical to the way science advances understanding. This at least strongly suggests that art also advances understanding. But one might argue there are differences between the two fields that undermine the epistemic standing of art. In the scientific example I began with, I took it for granted that the scientists knew what the experiment exemplified and what it indicated about the natural world. There was no ambiguity or indeterminacy. This is far from the case in the arts. Frequently, both what a work exemplifies and how its doing so bears on things beyond the work is unclear. Moreover, works of art admit of multiple interpretations. Ambiguity and indeterminacy, which are vices in science, are virtues in art. This is so, but it's important to remember that scientific results are often beset by such vices. A surprising result exemplifies something unexpected. Sometimes it's not at all clear what it exemplifies, or how we should extrapolate from the current case to anything else. Maybe the sample was contaminated. Then, although it exemplifies Q, there's no reason to believe that the substance we aimed to be experimenting on instantiates Q. It was a contaminated sample. Maybe the design is flawed, the experimental design. In that case, the result makes it manifest that we're not testing for what we thought we were. Maybe the solution we're studying is different or more complex than we thought. Then the surprising result exemplifies a deeper misunderstanding of the phenomena. Our ordinary orientation towards interpretation in the arts is the one we're forced to when things go wrong, as they often do in science. Rather than taking the experimental result to exemplify transparently, we have to ask ourselves, what are we to make of this? What exactly does it exemplify? This is a stance we routinely adopt when confronting a challenging work of art. Still, I don't claim that the sciences and the arts function in exactly the same way. Science strives for determinacy, univocality, and intersubjective agreement. Art revels in indeterminacy, multiplicity of correct interpretations, and intersubjective disagreement. That critics will never achieve consensus on the question of whether Hamlet was mad or sane is not a flaw in the play. It would be a flaw in the Michelson-Morley experiment if, in the long run, scientists could never achieve consensus as to whether it shows that there is no ether drift, or that ether drift is too slight to detect, or that the experiment is too badly designed to detect anything whatsoever. Because science values intersubjective agreement, it demands results on which agreement can be reached. It therefore sets limits on precision. This actually is the opposite of the stereotype. People think science is precise, art is vague. Actually, science is imprecise, and art is precise. If agreement up to a certain number of antecedently specified figures is significant, there's agreement. Any divergence of opinion beyond the significant figures is scientifically irrelevant. Art takes the opposite view. It values precision. The finest differences in certain respects may matter to the interpretation of a work of art. But if infinitely fine distinctions can matter, then disagreement is to be expected and should be tolerated and maybe even cherished. Because science progresses by building on previous findings, it requires agreement about what those findings were and what they established. To achieve such agreement, the sources of disagreement must be eliminated. So science favors the quantitative over the qualitative. In measuring acidity, it's far easier to deploy a digital readout device and get agreement as to whether the pH value of a solution is 5.4 than it is to settle by direct observation exactly what shade of pink the litmus paper is. Science, therefore, regiments. Art does not progress in this way. Although artists are undeniably influenced by their predecessors, they don't just pick up where their predecessors left off. So art favors the qualitative. Calculating to some antecedently specified number of significant figures the dimensions of the Mona Lisa's smile is of no interest to art. This is one reason why works of art reward repeated readings. If every difference, no matter how small or subtle, has the capacity to make a difference, and any aspect of the work might conceivably be significant, then it's reasonable to expect to find something new when one returns to a rich work of art. But if only a few differences in dimensions matter, and only up to an antecedently acknowledged point, there's limited value in mining an old scientific result for new insights. Better you should design a new experiment. Emotion figures more centrally in art than it does in science. By this, I do not mean that works of art evoke emotion more than science does, or that art evokes stronger emotions than science does. I don't think either of those is true. But I suggest art advances understanding through the expression of emotions to a greater degree than science does. I've argued elsewhere that emotions function cognitively. They provide orientations and create saliences that make us aware of aspects of things we might otherwise overlook. The fear occasioned by an impending exam underscores for the inattentive student how much reading she has left to do, how little of Kant she understands, and how much time she's wasted. Her fear is more than a pang of distress. It's an orientation to the past, present, and future, which heightens or perhaps even reveals to her for the first time aspects of her academic situation that she has so far conveniently ignored. The student's panic can underscore the same features of her situation for onlookers. They too might suddenly appreciate how badly she's frittered away her time and how dire her situation actually is. They too become reoriented to her past, present, and future as the result of discerning her emotional state. Emotions expressed by works of art afford similar insights. Velázquez's Infanta Margarita Teresa in Blue portrays the 8-year-old Infanta. Her pose is regal, her accoutrements are opulent. But she's trapped in an immobilizing gown, unable to move. She's completely unfree, nothing but a pawn in a political game. And I will mention that many women, on seeing this picture, the first thing you think is you couldn't move in that dress. You know, it's really immobilizing. But she is completely unfree. She's a pawn in a political game. Foreign policy considerations dictate whom she will marry and when. In fact, this portrait was made to send out to potential suitors, which is to say emperors and things they wanted to marry her to. Yes, the 8-year-old girl, never mind. The painting expresses her fragility and loneliness and the hopelessness of her plight. She was born to be married off for Spain's political advantage. Her well-being is irrelevant. The painting makes manifest that the rich and seemingly powerful, as well as the poor and powerless, suffer such constraints. It invites us to consider what other, perhaps less vivid conditions beyond their control restrict people's freedom and limit their lives. Both science and art critically involve sensation. Whatever works of art do, they impinge on our sense organs. We see paintings and hear music. And however abstract and theoretical our scientific claims, they too must ultimately be grounded in sensory observations. To account for the way science advances understanding, we must accommodate observation as well. This is obvious and not very interesting. But I suggest the role of sensation in art and science may be more significant than this suggests. Ever since Descartes, epistemology has framed itself around the worry that we might not know anything at all. But most of the time, our difficulty is exactly the opposite. The problems that typically confront us are problems of plenty. We're victims of information overload. Too many factors impinge on our sense organs. Reality presents itself to us, in William James's terms, as a blooming, buzzing confusion. To make sense of anything, we need to ignore the vast majority of our sensory inputs and structure the rest. Ordinarily, we use common sense procedures and mundane categories to do the job. This is not an altogether bad idea. Common sense would not be so common if it hadn't served us and our forebears pretty well. Mundane categories classify things in ways that enable us to get on with our ordinary activities. But to stick to the tried and true is to overlook a lot, and often to be unaware both of what we're overlooking and even that we're overlooking. One important function of art is to reorient and refine the sensibilities. Works of art may convince us of the value of adopting perspectives, attending to factors, or projecting along patterns we typically ignore. A work of art contrives a context in which patterns, properties, and perspectives are rendered salient. We develop a capacity to attune ourselves to them and play out their consequences. If we find that the consequences are intriguing or significant, we have reason to attend to the pattern elsewhere as well. The Judson Dance Theater is a group of postmodern dancers in New York who make dance out of ordinary movements. Their dances are mundane, pedestrian, non-stylized, and uninflected. They're the sort of movements you might see on the street. Dancers walk, run, climb over barriers, and carry heavy loads. Which raises the question, why should we go to a performance to watch this sort of thing? Why should we pay for a ticket? This is the same sort of thing you see out on the street. Sally Bain suggests that the answer lies in the defamiliarization that these works produce, a process by which what is familiar is rendered strange. The idea is this. When something is familiar, we're so accustomed to it that we don't look at it or attend to it. A passing glance enables us to recognize it for what it is and move on. Defamiliarization heightens awareness of things that are so obvious that we routinely ignore them. We walk, run, climb, and see others doing so without giving it much thought. When we carry a mattress, which is one of the Justin Dance Theater's activities, we do give it thought. We're painfully aware that carrying a mattress is hard. It requires continually readjusting our bodies to accommodate the awkwardly shifting center of gravity of the bulky, heavy, unwieldy burden. But we're intent on the task. We want to get the mattress moved. So we attend to the task and not our doing of it. The Judson dancers make us mindful of the physical intelligence that goes into such mundane activities. We notice and attune ourselves to the minute, intricate muscular adjustments involved in keeping one's balance while schlepping the mattress. We notice the rise and fall, the small and large physical adjustments that it takes to walk across or run across the floor. The dances then exemplify features that mundane motion instantiates, but that we, either makers or observers of that motion, routinely overlook. I said earlier that arts allow for infinite precision. The slightest similarities and differences, parallels and discrepancies, can make an enormous difference in a work of art. So by engaging with works, we come to discern minute similarities and differences, to attend to them, and to attend to where and why they might matter. We are then in a position to recognize them and appreciate their significance when they occur elsewhere in our lives. Works of art can shift figure and ground. Ordinarily, a representational painting, shape is a means for depicting objects. Cézanne reverses this and uses the depiction of objects as a way to sensitize us to shapes. We look at our surroundings differently after engaging with Cézanne. This is the point Goodman was making. In everyday life, we standardly consider form to be but a vehicle for conveying content. If the content is adequately conveyed, the form doesn't much matter. But in works of art, form matters as much as content. Moreover, form informs and thereby, to some extent, constitutes content. This is obvious in painting, music, and poetry. But having seen it there, we become sensitized to the way form and content intertwine and even fuse in ordinary discourse. We become aware that how a point is made factors into what point is made. Works of art reconfigure a domain in ways that bring to light aspects of things we would otherwise overlook. We thus enrich our cognitive resources through our encounters with the arts. Some properties, such as being visible or green or heavy, dovetail with our reactions in such a way that without those reactions, the properties would not exist. These properties are response-dependent. They're genuine properties of objects, of the objects that possess them, but they owe their identities to the responses they evoke. Greenness is the property it is because of the effects it has on the likes of us. Electromagnetic waves of suitable wavelength would exist whether they evoked the response or not. But if organisms were unresponsive to that range of wavelengths, there'd be no such property as greenness. Secondary qualities, such as colors, tones, and flavors, are response dependent. They're known by perception and perhaps cannot be fully known without perception. As Locke recognized, although we think of them as monadic properties, they're really relations involving potential sentient subjects. According to a familiar criterion for colors, something is green just in case it would look green to a normal observer under normal conditions. Conditions are often normal, and most of us are normal color perceivers, so most of us can determine for ourselves whether something's green. But the criterion for secondary qualities is not always the response of a normal perceiver. In identifying a note's pitch, the criterion is not how it would sound to a normal perceiver, but how it would sound to a perceiver with absolute pitch. Many of us cannot determine for ourselves whether an instrument is properly tuned. We defer to the expert. The capacity to distinguish among secondary qualities is neither uniform nor fixed. One perceiver might consider two colors or tones identical, while another readily distinguishes between them. A single person's capacity to discriminate may vary over time and with circumstances. Colors that look indistinguishable against one background are often easily distinguished against another. Moreover, and this is crucial, perceptual abilities are subject to refinement. We can develop the ability to distinguish between properties we could not previously tell apart. People who take a wine tasting course, for example, come away able to discriminate wines that they originally couldn't tell the difference between. People who study solfège become more adept at discriminating tones. Response dependent is not restricted to Locke's secondary qualities. Many moral properties, emotional properties, and evaluative properties are response dependent as well. An action is contemptible if it would evoke contempt in a suitable subject under suitable circumstances. A situation is frightening if it would evoke fear in a suitable subject. An action of whatever sort is excellent if it would be so evaluated by a suitable subject. For example, an excellent football play is one that would be deemed excellent by someone who is competent to judge such things, someone who really knows the game. Just as our responses to secondary qualities are neither uniform nor fixed, neither are our responses to other response-dependent properties. As we refine our sensibilities, we become better discerners of those properties. Many of the properties that are important in the arts are secondary qualities and properties that depend or supervene on secondary qualities. So the refinement of the sensibilities that the arts foster involves an augmentation of our sensibility to response-dependent properties. This is one reason why the cognitive aspect of art cannot be divorced from its object. We cannot extract the cognitive content, repackage it, and leave the work of art and our encounter with it behind. But there's another point that's perhaps even more intriguing. I said that response-dependent properties owe their identities to the responses they evoke. This means that if the arts or the sciences or any other human activity actually refines or extends the sensibilities, they create new properties. If they enable us to see or feel or hear what no one has ever been able to see or hear or feel before, they have brought a new property into being. If, for example, scientists devised lenses that enabled us to see into the ultraviolet region in the same way that we see visible light, they would, by extending our sensory range, create a new color, ultraviolet, as well as it would be a new color in the way that violet or pink is a color, as well as being the range of electromagnetic radiation that we've got there anyway. As far as I know, you can't do any such thing. But art, I suggest, does refine our sensibilities and create new response-dependent properties. When, for example, Cervantes described Don Quixote's tilting at windmills, he made manifest, perhaps for the first time, that some actions are simultaneously misguided, noble, hopeless, and eminently worth pursuing. Such acts are, in a word, quixotic. But we don't need a word to recognize the property. Being quixotic seems clearly a response-dependent property. Quixotic actions would have nothing worth noting in common if it were not for the responses they evoke. That mixture of admiration, bemusement, and slight condescension that keys us into the peculiar combination of futility, admirability, and benightedness of the quixotic quest. So it seems, until Don Quixote exemplified that quixoticism, there was no such property. By making it salient, Cervantes brought it into being. To be sure, the potential was there all along, but until subjects were suitably primed to respond to it, it wasn't yet real. The point is a delicate one. A response-dependent property is a property that would evoke a suitable response in a suitable subject under suitable circumstances. Since the requirement is counterfactual, it's possible that although the property is real, no such response is ever evoked. So it might seem that we could take the view that quixoticism existed all along, but no one happened to notice it until Cervantes wrote his novel. The issue, though, is what it takes to be a suitable subject. Presumably, that requires having the capacity, when circumstances are right, to respond appropriately. So, for example, Hume's missing shade of blue exists and is a response-dependent property, even if no one ever sees it. Anyone who's not colorblind would appropriately respond if she happened to encounter it. If all response-dependent properties are like that, then we're passive reactors. The only issue is whether we happen to encounter the proper stimulus. In that case, all response-dependent properties exist, regardless of whether anyone has the occasion to respond to them. But if, as I've maintained, our sensibilities can be refined, enhanced, and extended, then as this happens, new properties come into being. I don't contend that the arts alone have the capacity to create new response-dependent properties. But I think the arts are especially suited to the job. They're more concerned with the qualitative than the quantitative. They're concerned to exemplify subtle, complex, nuanced, sensory, emotional, and evaluative properties. They manipulate circumstances to bring to light aspects of things that were previously undetected and arguably undetectable. If they enable us to discern what we could not previously discern, and some of the properties they enable us to discern are response-dependent, then those properties come into being just as people develop the capacity to discern them. Nelson Goodman maintains that the arts and the sciences engage in world-making. Many believe that his term world-making is hyperbolic and misleading as a characterization of what the arts and sciences do. And to some extent, this seems right. But if there are response-dependent properties, and if the arts, the sciences, or both are capable of engendering capacities for responses that people previously did not have and could not have, then the arts, the sciences, or both are capable of creating new properties. They thereby contribute to the constitution of the world they pertain to. Manifestly, whether this hypothesis is true or not, the arts, like the sciences, reconfigure our world, enabling us to see things we otherwise would not, and to understand things in ways we otherwise would not. Arguably, they contribute to the creation of some of the items that are constituents of the world. That being so, an adequate epistemology needs to accommodate them both. And I've argued that the account should show how these two enterprises work together. Thank you.